From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. It's the 25th anniversary of Monty Python's Flying Circus. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, we celebrate the occasion by featuring interviews with four original members of the comedy group: John Cleese, Terry Jones, Michael Palin, and the late Graham Chapman. Also, film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the new adventure movie The River Wild, starring Meryl Streep. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Barbara Campbell. A tentative agreement reached by negotiators for General Motors and the United Auto Workers Union could end a strike by more than 11,000 workers in Flint, Michigan. Don Gagne reports from Detroit.
The settlement came after a three-hour morning bargaining session on day four of the strike at GM's sprawling Buick City complex in Flint. The walkout had forced several GM plants around the country to close because of parts shortages. More plants would have shut down next week, but that appears to have been avoided. Union bargainers say they have reached a satisfactory agreement on the issue of employment levels at the complex. Workers have long complained about mandatory 6- and 7-day work weeks as the company attempted to keep up with growing demand for its products without actually hiring new people. Details of the settlement have not been released. A ratification vote is scheduled for tomorrow. For National Public Radio, this is Don Gagne in Detroit.
A search team says it has found the wreckage of the ferry Estonia, which sank in the Baltic Sea. The crew hopes to send remote-controlled cameras to examine the ship tomorrow to look for the exact cause of the disaster, which killed more than 900 people. Exiled President Jean-Bertrand Aristide is urging Haitians to remain calm. Aristide says he has prepared a radio address to his people. As many as three Haitians are reported to have been killed today in Port-au-Prince when pro-army gunmen disrupted a march that was marking the third anniversary of the military coup. The killings occurred outside the headquarters of a militia group that has been part of a reign of terror supporting the military regime. A federal commission is recommending that illegal aliens be denied welfare and other public benefits except in emergencies. And the commission recommends that the government set up a registry of Social Security numbers to keep track of who is in the U.S. legally. At least one group dealing with immigrant issues criticizes the plan. UPI's Carol Van Dam reports.
Though the commission's recommendations do not include a national worker identification card, critics suggest that is precisely what must happen if a national computerized system on immigrants is created, something the commission does recommend. Audrey Alvarado heads a Hispanic public interest group.
The National Council of La Raza, which I represent, believes that this recommendation is a giant leap down a very, very dangerous road.
Alvarado says she agrees illegal immigration must be controlled, but says a national database will lead to abuse. Carol Van Dam, Washington.
Americans' personal income rose in August, but not as much as their spending did. The government says income went up 0.4 points, while spending jumped 0.9 points. The spending hike was bigger than many analysts had predicted, and the largest increase since February. It suggests that the economy is still quite strong. Consumer spending accounts for 2/3 of the nation's gross domestic product. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 13 points. The Nasdaq is up 5. This is NPR. Campaign finance reform is apparently dead for the year following a Senate vote that failed to end a Republican filibuster. The Senate needed 60 votes to end the GOP delaying tactics, but the count was only 52 to 46. The legislation was intended to limit the amount of money any one source could give and to try to ease constituents' fears that their member of Congress is beholden to the biggest contributor. The measure would have put a $6,000 limit on gifts from political action committees. The package also would have rewarded congressional candidates who observed voluntary spending limits. The space shuttle Endeavour is in orbit on a mission to test the most powerful space radar system available for civilian use. Reporter Dave Pignanelli says the survey the crew is doing will help keep track of the state of the environment.
This mission is primarily geared to studying the environmental changes that occur here on planet Earth. It's all part of NASA's Mission to Planet Earth program, which is an ongoing program to study the environmental and climate change here on Earth. They'll be mapping different sections of the Earth using an imaging radar system, and then they'll compare those photos with similar photos taken last spring. And they're looking for environmental change that occurs naturally and environmental change that is most likely the cause by human intervention, such as pollution.
Dave Pignanelli of member station WMFE at the Kennedy Space Center. The shuttle was launched today 6 weeks late. The liftoff was delayed on August 18th when a technical problem shut down the engines in the final seconds of the countdown. A Postal Service spokeswoman says a Richard Nixon stamp is still being planned for next year, despite the objections of a House committee chairman. Congressman William Clay of Missouri says a president forced from office should not be honored and has written a letter of complaint to the Postmaster General. The spokeswoman says the Postal Service is following the tradition of honoring former presidents in the year after their deaths. I'm Barbara Campbell in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Good evening. Tonight, dinosaurs. I have here, sitting in the studio next to me, an elk. Oh, I'm sorry, an elk. Mrs. An Elk.
Miss.
Miss An Elk, who is an expert
no,
on
no,
the...
No, an elk.
What?
An elk, not an expert.
No, I was saying that you, Miss Elk, were an A-N, not A-N-N-E expert.
Oh.
On elks. I'm sorry, on dinosaurs.
Yes, I certainly am, Chris. How very true, my word, yes.
Now, Miss Elk, Anne, you have a new theory about the Brontosaurus.
Can I just say here, Chris, for one moment, that I have a new theory about the Brontosaurus?
Exactly. What is it?
Where?
No. What is your theory?
Oh, what is my theory?
Yes.
Oh, what is my theory that it is? Yes. Well, you may well ask, what is my theory?
I am asking.
And well, you may. Yes, my word, you may well ask what it is, this theory of mine. Well, this theory that I have, that is to say, which is mine... is mine.
I know it's yours. What is it?
Where? Oh, what is my theory?
Yes.
My theory that I have follows the lines that I am about to relate.
Our director assures me today's Fresh Air will go smoother than the program you just heard. This Sunday marks the 25th anniversary of the first BBC broadcast of Monty Python's Flying Circus. The group made TV shows for 3.5 years, creating a new style of sketch comedy that was sometimes literary, sometimes slapstick, often surreal. The Pythons declined to celebrate the anniversary with a reunion performance, but we're bringing together four of the Pythons in back-to-back interviews on this archive edition of our show. We start with a 1987 interview with Terry Jones. Jones wrote for the group and performed. He also directed the Python film The Life of Brian, a spoof of biblical epics about a Christ-like character. Terry Jones often played the female roles with the Pythons, and in The Life of Brian, he played Brian's mother. In this scene, she's breaking the news to Brian that he's not really one of the chosen people.
Well, Brian, your father isn't Mr. Cohen.
I never thought he was.
No, none of your cheek! He was a Roman, Brian. He was a centurion in the Roman army.
You mean you were raped?
Oh, at first, yes.
Who was it?
Nautius Maximus, his name was. Promised me the known world, he did. I was to be taken to Rome, housed by the forum, slaves, asses milk, as much gold as I could eat.
You know, I've always wondered, watching the Monty Python TV shows and also movies like The Life of Brian, how come each member of the cast was never identified with the characters that they played?
Well, I suppose it really came about because when we started doing Python, we very much felt ourselves as being an ensemble group. And we were sort of, we didn't really want to identify ourselves as individuals. The whole thing was to try and keep the, you know, Python as a group thing together. And I suppose that just sort of carried on through with the films. And I suppose the other reason is that, I mean, everybody played about, you know, far too many parts. If you started identifying them, I mean, you know, you had Mike Palin in Life of Brian playing about 16 parts or something. It'd be a never-ending list.
How would you describe the types of roles that you played when you were with Monty Python?
I describe them as the roles that nobody else would play, basically. I think that was the thing they had in common. That's really why I end up doing all the women, because people the others got fed up with playing women. So Mark you, my voice does tend to go up rather easily. It's the way the Welsh, you know. We sort of started trying to, as we went on, we started trying to cast against type in a way and sort of do things that we were, you know, that's maybe John, a part that John would naturally do, we'd give to Mike, and a part that Mike would naturally do, we'd give to me or Eric or something like that. We tried to mix it up, actually.
You did straight men a lot, didn't you?
I tended to in the TV shows, yes. I got a bit more outrageous as things went on, actually, when I sort of ended up doing, I think in Meaning of Life, I was Mr. Creosote. That's the fat man in the restaurant who explodes. And things like... My favourite part, actually, was the woman who had 60 children in the Every Sperm is Sacred song. That was, I think, my favourite role.
So you say you got the role of playing women because nobody else wanted it?
That was roughly it, actually, yes.
Was there a certain kind of woman that you had in mind when you would take on those roles?
Well, we were sort of doing sort of, I suppose I was doing sort of middle-aged, sort of rather ratty middle-aged rat bags, I suppose. But the awful thing is they always came out like looking like my mum. I mean, they didn't sound like my mum, but they certainly looked, I looked a spitting image of my mum when I had a scarf on and curlers on and things.
You wouldn't tell her that, would you?
No. Whether she spotted it or not, I don't know.
You did a lot of writing for Monty Python,
mm-hmm.
right? What are some of the favourite sketches that you wrote?
That I wrote? Gosh, I tell you what, it's terribly difficult to remember because it all merges into a
sort
of, uh-huh. you quite often you can't tell which is which. I remember writing the Lumberjack sketch with Mike. And
oh, the Lumberjack song?
Yes.
Oh, that's one of my favourites.
It was one of those moments. There's very few things that you can actually remember the moment of writing, but that one, we've been struggling with the sketch all day. There was a sketch about this psychopathic barber who kept on wanting to stab his patients. And I remember sort of at the end saying, we can't finish this sketch. Let's have a song. We never get out with a song. So Mike and I just sort of sat down and wrote the Lumberjack song, sort of line by line kind of thing.
Could you sing some of it?
Well, I think it goes, I can't remember. How does it go? Oh, I'm a lumberjack and I'm okay. I sleep all night and I work all day. I cut down trees, I skip and jump. I like to press wildflowers. On Wednesday I go shopping and hang around in bars.
I cut down trees, I skip and jump. He likes to press wildflowers. He puts on women's clothing and acts in bars.
I'm a lumberjack and I'm okay. I sleep all night. Cut down trees, I wear high heels, suspenders and a bra. I wish I'd been a girly, just like my dear papa.
Your approach to writing? Would you just sit around and free associate?
Yeah, it's a bit like that. I mean, it was very much sort of 9 till 5 job, you know, Terry, sort of getting up, sitting in front of a blank piece of paper and trying to sort of have some inspiration. Usually, I don't know where it comes from. I remember with the Mr. Creosote sketch, I remember sitting down with a blank piece of paper and writing at the top a sketch in the worst possible taste. And then the sketch came out of that, really. But I didn't know what it was going to be when I started off. Generally, our system used to be that we used to write individually. We'd write in pairs. I mean, I wrote with Mike Palin most of the time. But as we went on, it was very much Mike and I would write separately. Then we'd meet together, the two of us, read out what we've got, criticise, maybe swap over what we'd got and so carry on where the other one had left off. Kind of like consequences, really. And then after a couple of weeks writing, we'd maybe meet up with a group and then read out what we'd written to the group. And then there'd be the same sort of interchange would go on with sort of criticism and swapping over.
When you were with Monty Python, you first started to get into directing, which you're doing more of now. Remember all those film inserts in Monty Python for the TV show? Did you direct those?
No. What happened was that, I suppose, when Mike and I sort of, one of the reasons why we got into performing was that we originally started as writers on television, and we gradually began to realise that, you know, that we'd write things and then they'd be done, weren't being done how we wanted them to be done. So we started performing things as well. And as we got into the performance, we gradually realised how crucial the direction was as well. Like, it was absolutely crucial to have the right locations. I remember one example in a series that we wrote, or that we were in, called The Complete and Utter History. This was just before Python. And we'd written, it was a lot of it on film, and we were doing this scene, which was meant to be the Battle of Harfleur or something, the English versus the French. And we had the French just as onion sellers with striped jerseys and, you know, berets and French loaves and onions on their bicycles. That was the French army kind of thing. It was pretty sort of crude stuff. But the whole point of the writing of it was we staged it like, you know, they appeared on the horizon. We wanted a cliff, you know, with them to appear on the horizon like the Indians at some sort of, in some western or something. We got to this location. It's all sort of gentle rolling hills with forests. And you couldn't do the shot. You know, and we'd say, what are we doing here? This is not, we can't do it. And, you know, we had to shoot it. But, you know, it made the thing look very much weaker than it was actually. You lost the parody in it. So it was gradually this realization that everything was crucial in comedy. You know, the location, the costumes, the makeup, as well as who's acting it and who's and what they're saying. Everything's crucial. It's more like poetry, I would feel. So when we actually came to doing Python, I was by this stage sort of very keen to sort of keep an eye on what the director was doing. And we had a very good director, Ian McNaughton. But it was a bit of a struggle to begin with because it's like I was infringing on his territory, sort of always keeping an eye on where the camera was and everything. But as the series went on, it began to get much easier and we began to work much better together.
You know, I figured that all of you who were in Monty Python probably came from very straight-laced, goal-oriented, disciplined, middle-class families. Is that right?
Yes, I suppose so.
Well, what about you?
Things tend not to be quite so goal-orientated in England. It's not quite the same as over here. But certainly sort of very straight middle-class, lower middle-class families. My dad was a bank clerk. And so I grew up in a household where we never had any money. There was we never had a car, for example. So it was kind of a genteel poverty, if you like, trying to keep up an appearance of respectability.
You went to Oxford, though, didn't you?
Yes.
How did you get there? Isn't that a very expensive school?
No, it's all free in England. I mean, it probably won't be much longer with Mrs. Thatcher around, but up till now, it's all been free.
You had planned on becoming an English teacher, right?
Well, not really. I sort of grew up being a poet, really, from the age of about 7 onwards. I was always going to be a poet, actually, Terry.
Oh, okay.
And, but then I found that, you know, sort of grammar school rather sort of educates you out of being a poet. You know, the one thing they do teach you is there's no money in poetry. I learned this lesson. And the only thing, you know, I could possibly see myself qualified for doing after sort of, you know, all that schooling was teaching, well, you know, becoming an academic of some sort. But then when I was at Oxford, I realised I was sitting in the Bodleian Library, which is this beautiful old library that was built about sort of 500 years ago. I was sitting in this library and I suddenly looked up and I was getting really angry about what somebody had written, about what somebody else had written, about what Milton had written. And I suddenly looked around and looked at everybody else sort of sitting there and thinking, how many people else are getting worked up about this? And I suddenly thought, I don't want to do this. Maybe when I'm 60, but at the moment I'd rather write the thing in the first place. So it was a kind of a moment of decision where I thought, I'm going to actually start writing stuff for myself rather than writing commentaries about what other people are writing, what other people are about, writing about what somebody else has written about.
Did that lead you into comedy, this realization?
Yes, I suppose it did. Again, it's kind of accident in a way. I was involved in what we call a review, which is kind of like a show with sort of sketches and songs and things. And we did these, a group of us from Oxford, do them in Edinburgh, at the Edinburgh Festival. And then when I came down after 3 years, we got an offer to do this show that we'd been doing in Edinburgh in London for about 6 weeks. So I sort of eased into it that way. Never ever sort of really thinking that's what I was going to make my livelihood out of.
But you had met, I guess, Michael Palin in Oxford. Were you the core group of Monty Python? Were you the two who organized it?
Well, it kind of happened like I met Mike at Oxford, and we didn't actually write very much there together, but we did, after Mike came down, we started working and writing stuff for the BBC. We were then offered to do a TV show and actually appear in it, a TV show for children called Do Not Adjust Your Set. And it was involving Eric Idle, and Terry Gilliam then turned up when we were making these shows and did a couple of cartoons for us. So that was a kind of core group. It was me, Michael Palin, Eric Idle, and then Terry Gilliam came along. And when John Cleese and Graham Chapman said, how about doing something together to Mike and me? Well, we said, all right, well, can we bring Eric and Terry Gilliam along? And that's really how Python happened. It was always very much a sort of an anarchist sort of collective, you know. The six of us there, you know, working together and writing equally, which again goes back to your first question about why we didn't actually sort of, you know, identify ourselves. It was very much sort of immersing ourselves in a group.
Terry Jones recorded in 1987. He has a new book called Lady Coddington's Pressed Fairy Book. We'll hear from Michael Palin after this break. This is Fresh Air. Today we're celebrating the 25th anniversary of the first broadcast of Monty Python's Flying Circus.
Alan Hutchison reads another extract from a series of bedside books.
Number 32. The lady lies with her left leg planted firmly on the ground and the right hand waiting. The gentleman with the melon switches on the battery and places his left thigh on the edge of the swivel table, keeping the neck of the stuffed goose absolutely...
Up next, we have an interview with Michael Palin, a founding member of the Pythons. He also co-starred in the Python films and in the film A Fish Called Wanda, in which he played the stuttering thief. In 1990, I asked him about his upbringing.
Well, I was a nice middle-class boy, I suppose. I mean, my mother didn't work. My father was an engineer by trade and was born and brought up in the south of England. He was a doctor's son. And... he became an export manager of a big steelworks in Sheffield. I don't think he really particularly wanted to do that. I mean, I think he'd actually been much happier to be a church organist, but one was sort of pushed into the professions then. And so we lived on really very low salary in quite a nice house in Sheffield.
You grew up after the war. How did the post-war days affect your sensibility, do you think? And, you know, your worldview when you were young?
Well, the days of austerity and scarcity here, and I can remember countries like America and Australia especially were like the land of plenty where all the opportunities were. It meant in a strange way that you sort of guarded what you had rather carefully. I mean, my father was a real notebook man and kept brown paper bags for several years, you know, and used to iron bits of string. It was that sort of thing, and had lots and lots of little tins with sort of, you know, left-handed cufflinks and things in one tin and bits of, you know, sort of old Brazil nut shells in another. We kept absolutely everything. And I quite like that. I'm still rather... I love detail myself, both in sort of life and work. I tend to notice bits of detail. And in a sense, it's made me sort of... or perhaps helped to make me feel very sort of fond of life and rather sort of... glad that I've got what I have now and that we are brought up in a time of comparative plenty.
Michael Palin is my guest, and he's speaking to us from the NPR London Bureau. The Pythons always had a lot of drag humor. I was wondering if you were ever taken to drag shows or, you know, to female impersonation shows when you were younger.
No, not really. I went to pantomime, which is a peculiarly English phenomenon, I think, isn't it? You don't have pantomime in America.
Well, explain what it is.
Well, it's a Christmas show based on a reworking of a fairy story like Jack and the Beanstalk or Babes in the Wood, in which the women play the men and the men play the women.
I don't think we have that.
Well, they have principal boy, which is always played by a woman in a big pair of black tights and sort of little costume. She slaps her thigh a lot, and, you know, the woman would play Dick Whittington, for instance, and say, "Come on, puss," and all that in a sort of very butch voice. And the men would play the ugly sisters in Cinderella. So that was my first, I suppose, that, you know, every Christmas I would see men in getting laughs out of being in drag, playing things like the ugly sisters or Dick Whittington's mother or things like that. And they were always fairly incompetent. I don't know if that's a sign of, you know, what men, how men saw themselves or how men saw women, but there you are.
How often did you dress in drag for the Python shows?
it sounds like sort of drag addicts confessions, doesn't it? Not really that often. Uh-huh. I should think probably once every other show we got into women's outfits. Strange, isn't it, really? But I must say we did quite enjoy it. Because Python was sort of rather like, I mean, people say, why didn't you get women to play the women in Python? But that wasn't really the point. Python itself was sort of a really self-contained show where the six writers did everything. And the sort of many of the characters were rather sort of caricatures, or fairly outrageous, of a sort of cartoon feel to them. And so we were playing types of men rather than the man himself. And we were playing types of women as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I never convinced myself as a woman, whereas someone like Eric or Graham could look really rather wonderful. And Terry Jones, used to play his mother regularly and was wonderful. You know, one could almost think, I wish Terry would stay like that. He'd make someone a wonderful mum.
Did you usually write your own roles?
Yes. I suppose that the major roles in any sort of sketch were usually those written by the writer of that sketch. And there were a lot of subsidiary roles in it, which really you wrote for other people. But very often, yes, if you had a particularly extraordinary character, which you really only you could put across, you ended up doing that after a read-through.
When the Monty Python group broke up, was it hard at all at the beginning to figure out what to do as an individual as opposed to being part of an ensemble?
Yes, because Python was such a sort of cast such a long shadow, it's quite difficult to get out of it. I knew that I wanted to do something different from Python because, that's the way you had to go. You had to go perhaps sort of unnaturally far away in order to get away from its influence.
Michael Palin, formerly of Monty Python's Flying Circus. More pythons in the second part of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the light side of life. If life seems jolly rotten, there's something you've forgotten, and that's to laugh and smile and dance and sing. When you're feeling in the dumps, don't be silly chumps, just purse your lips and whistle, that's the thing. Hey.
Always look on the bright side of life.
Come on.
Always look on the bright side of life.
For life is quite absurd, and death's the final word. You must always face the curtain with a bow. Forget about your scene, give the audience a grin. Enjoy it, it's your last chance anyhow.
So always look on the bright side of death. Just before you draw your terminal breath.
Life's a busy-ish when you look at it. Life's a laugh and death's a joke, it's true. You'll see it's all a show. Keep 'em laughing as you go. Just remember that the
major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, we continue our Monty Python tribute. We'll feature interviews from our archives with John Cleese and the late Graham Chapman. This Sunday marks the 25th anniversary of the Python's first broadcast. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews The River Wild, starring Meryl Streep and Kevin Bacon. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Barbara Campbell. A demonstration marking the anniversary of the coup in Haiti has erupted into violence. Reports say as many as three people have been killed in fighting between troops of the military rulers and supporters of the exiled president. The two groups clashed outside the office of a militia group that supports the military rulers. U.S. troops did not intervene. American forces took over Haiti's radio and television operations today, saying that the people of the island would now begin to hear the truth. The stations had been broadcasting anti-United States messages. They had been run by the military government. U.S. officials also say the broadcasts had been inciting the Haitian people to violence. The head of Sweden's Maritime Safety Division says the doors on the bow of the ferry Estonia were open when it sank into the Baltic Sea, killing 900 people. The official says six other incidents in ferries with open doors have been reported since the Estonia sank, the BBC's Juliet Bremner reports.
The six near accidents have been reported to the Swedish Maritime Board by staff working on ferries who've come forward since the Estonia disaster. Sweden's Director of Maritime Safety, Bengt Erik Svenmark, admitted that he was shocked by the revelations, particularly since some ship owners had neglected to report the incidents. Mr. Svenmark said it suggested that bow sections of roll-on, roll-off ferries could take on water in the high sea conditions found in the Baltic. He confirmed that all the indications were that this is what had happened to the Estonia, although there was still a possibility that improperly secured cargo may have shifted. Because of the new fears raised by the reports, the Swedish Maritime Board is ordering a full inspection of all ferries with opening bow doors, which currently use the country's ports.
Juliet Bremner reporting. The opening session of the Japanese parliament was marred today by a bipartisan power struggle and a boycott. The opposition stayed away from the proceedings, leaving Prime Minister Tomiichi Murayama to deliver his address to a half-filled chamber. NPR's Julie McCarthy reports.
A new bloc in Japan's badly splintered parliament united long enough today to agree to boycott Prime Minister Murayama's keynote speech. There hasn't been a move like it since 1966, when the Socialists, then the largest opposition party, refused to attend because of a political funding scandal. Today, the Socialists rule in an unlikely coalition with the conservative LDP, and Prime Minister Murayama, who is also the Socialist Party leader, looked anguished as he addressed the half-empty chamber. He acknowledged the Japanese public is deeply distrustful of Japan's scandal-ridden politics and vowed to pursue deeper reforms. Murayama's own lurch to the political center has undercut his government's credibility, and the boycott by the newly organized opposition alliance is part of a strategy to weaken it further and force early elections. In Tokyo, this is Julie McCarthy.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 11 points. This is NPR. Workers are unloading nuclear waste from Europe at South Carolina's Savannah River nuclear weapons plant. State officials say they'll try to keep any more shipments from entering the state. South Carolina had gone all the way to the Supreme Court to try to keep the nuclear waste out, but the courts refused to bar the shipment. The Energy Department says the U.S. has obligated itself to take the spent fuel rods, to keep that material out of the wrong hands, to reduce the spread of nuclear weapons. The South Carolina Attorney General says he's resigned to this shipment being stored at Savannah River, but he'll fight the next shipment, which is scheduled to leave Europe next year. A new study by the National Institutes of Health finds that patients suffering from clogged arteries can reduce their chances of stroke dramatically if they undergo surgery. NPR's Patricia Naiman reports.
Researchers followed 662 men and women in 39 hospitals around the country who were at risk of stroke because of clogged arteries in the neck. All the patients received one aspirin a day, along with counseling to stop smoking and treatment for high blood pressure and high cholesterol. Half the patients also underwent surgery, carotid endarterectomy, in order to remove fatty deposits from the arteries in the neck. For these patients, doctors found risk of stroke was decreased by 55% compared to patients who didn't have surgery. Until now, there was no convincing evidence that the surgery was superior to aspirin treatment. Every year, about 500,000 Americans suffer strokes. I'm Patricia Namond reporting.
UN officials say all foreign aid workers have left the largest refugee camp serving one of the largest refugee camps serving Rwandans after bandits from the Hutu ethnic group seized control of the camp and threatened the relief workers. The incident occurred at the Kitale refugee camp in Zaire as U.S. and Zairean officials were meeting about security. I'm Barbara Campbell, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
And now for something completely different.
On this archive edition of Fresh Air, we're celebrating the 25th anniversary of Monty Python's Flying Circus. Their first BBC broadcast was on October 2, 1969. John Cleese is perhaps the most famous of the Pythons. After the group split up, he starred in the BBC series Fawlty Towers and wrote and starred in the 1988 film A Fish Called Wanda. He just wrote a sequel, and he's been turning up in a lot of TV commercials. When I spoke with the former minister of Silly Walks in 1990, it wasn't comedy that brought him to town. It was a family therapy conference where he led a seminar with his former therapist, Robin Skinner, who you can hear laughing in the background during our interview.
Now, so much of your humor has to do with, kind of skewering a certain businessman mentality or civil service mentality. Now, your father was an insurance salesman, and I wonder if you got some of what those people were like from watching your father and his
sure that's right. And I think if somebody had to say what's the thread running almost all the way through my work, it's something to do with trying to escape from a sort of rather narrow, rather respectable, lower middle class inhibition. And that's really what my work's been about, if I think about it. And Wanda was a supreme example of that, where Archie finally sort of throws it all up and disappears to Rio with Jamie Lee Curtis, you know. So I think that that's probably been informing my work more than anything else, along, I think, with two other things. I think that people in their work meetings often try and laugh at the thing that frightens them most and attempt to sort of make it less threatening. And I've always been scared of anger. The English are very uncomfortable with anger. I don't know if it's anything particularly to do with my family, but it's certainly to do with the English family, more than the British family, if you see what I mean. They hate anger. They regard it as a loss of face to really, you know, sound off, and they find it very difficult to express it, and so they get pushed around a bit, and they don't complain well if they get bad service. And the other thing is that because of, I think, something early in my life too, I've always been very scared of lack of communications. I've laughed at that a great deal.
Wait, can I ask you to talk in no language for a second, speaking of lack of communication?
In
no language. You have this way of speaking in no language in particular.
Oh, the Cards and the Tempertonies. Yeah, well, they composed an overcall at the Murgatruses. There's Stavila, across the bottom, part of Isaac Cruz, together in mid slever, the underpedity, and fourth frame shows data vision and auditory slope of action. But I won't go on about that at the moment. I know it's confusing if you haven't heard it before.
So is this kind of what you're doing?
Yeah, I mean, the first time I actually heard an English guy called Stanley Unwin talking that nonsense when I was 17, I mean, I laughed for about a week. I mean, I just laughed till I hurt.
How did you learn to speak in that gobbledygook?
Believe it or not, it is, when I was 18, I wrote it down, and I simply wrote it.
Really?
Yeah, the first half of words and put the second half of other words on. I can't make it up. It sounds as if I'm making it up, but that's actually something that I learned for a house entertainment at Clifton College in 1958, and I've never forgotten it. It got me into the Footlights in Cambridge, too, is how I started there.
Oh, that's great. Now, your mother was an acrobat? this happens to me all the time.
I'm fed up sometimes. People send me these.
No, you know, I always, like, very seriously read, you know, these bios of the people I'm interviewing. And there's usually like one piece of information that is so dreadfully wrong.
I forgot I put that on some bio.
Oh, so you wrote that.
Oh, yeah.
No, I'm reading the stuff about you, and I know half of this is probably made up, and I have no idea which half it is.
That's right. Yeah. No, you're quite right. You get fed up fitting those biographies in, and you do put in the odd thing, and then, of course, it's played back to you a few months later. You've totally forgotten it. No, she wasn't too much of an acrobat. She was staid-ish, played the piano, and otherwise was a housewife.
We're featuring a 1990 interview with John Cleese. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. John Cleese, who were the first people who you realized you could do convincing characterizations of?
The first dozen things I did were very derivative of things that other people had done that had made me laugh. But after that, I used the fact that if somebody is going to have a nervous tick, you know, and make chicken noises now and again, it's much funnier if they're the head of the Secret Service or the chairman of the Bank of England than if they're a tobacconist. So I use my ability to pass myself off as a sort of establishment figure because of my public school education to portray these kind of people. Because, as I say, the more serious and grave they are, the funnier it is when they start going a bit crazy.
This seems like there's a time in your life when you could have swung either way, either into the real straight life
mm-hmm.
or into a parody of that.
When I left Cambridge, I was actually signed up to join a huge firm of solicitors in the City of London called Freshfields, who were solicitors to the Bank of England, and about half the partners were lords or knights or something. So and if the BBC hadn't come along about a week before I left Cambridge and seen the review that we were all doing, Timbrook Taylor and Bill Oddie and a number of other people who've been successful in show business and offered us all jobs, I imagine I would have gone and been a solicitor and done that for 15, 20 years before killing myself.
That's grim.
Well, I mean, no, I think you're a solicitor. I think killing yourself's quite a cheerful prospect.
Well, he's grinning.
Now, but you actually have a foot in the corporate world in the sense that you have a production company that does corporate training films, does advertisements for corporations.
Well, no, it's more management and sales training films. We have done a few sponsored or commissioned films for some companies mm-hmm. in England, but that's a minority thing. It's the films hired by big institutions to train their employees to learn certain skills. It's taken a little time to get over the fact that most of our films are humorous, and this puts people back on their heels a bit if they don't understand the difference between being serious, when I believe you can also be very funny, and being solemn. If they're confused about being serious and solemn and think that if you're being funny, you can't be being serious. If they're confused in that way, then they don't like the idea of using our film so much. But we're overcoming that resistance very rapidly. But most of our business is in the East Coast at the moment, and around Chicago, as I say, where the office is.
I actually have a little clip here of one of the training films.
One of the video arts films?
Yeah, and this is one that I assume you wrote, that you star in. And this is like how to not be a repairman.
Oh, yes, the serviceman.
You play a serviceman who's called in to repair a piece of factory equipment. And the person at the factory has said that the machine is making a loud noise. And he's trying to describe it.
What sort of peculiar noise? Oh, well, a sort of scraping.
What, a grating, or a crunching, or a high-pitched squeaking, or a harsh metallic scratching, or a hollow, full-throated humming, or a dry, reedy, sputtering, falsetto squealing, or a plangent, stridulous, crescendoing rasp, or a sibilant, twangy, clamorous, droning countertenor snorting, or...?
It was a sort of harsh, metallic sound.
What, steady, or pulsating, or measured, or intermittent, or seasonal, or cyclical, or rhythmic?
It was pulsating.
Evenly, or...
Evenly.
Staccato?
No, not staccato.
Loud?
Fairly.
So it was a fairly loud, evenly pulsating, harsh, metallic, glissandoing, scratchy sort of peculiar noise.
Yes.
Right.
That's an excerpt from one of the training films that John Cleese's company does. That's really funny stuff. I'm sure all of our listeners are wondering, well, how come he's not making films full-time? Why is he devoting so much of his time to this production company that does training films?
Well, I think it's a question of two things. First of all, a feature film is an appallingly heavy commitment. I mean, Wanda certainly took me, I think, 2 years and 2 or 3 months of my life. That's after I've squidged it all together, because it's not all in a continuous line. But so before you take 2 years to write and produce a film, because I hate acting in them, you see, I'm only prepared to do that if I've actually written them. Then it sort of becomes worthwhile to complete the circle and make the whole project done. But if you don't want to take 2 years off to make a film, and you only want to do that occasionally, then it's lovely to be able to do smaller projects here and there. And what I particularly like is any sort of project that's connected with, I suppose, the way people behave or something to do with the human mind, because this is what really interests me. The other thing is, once you've made enough money, and I've now sort of got enough money to coast, you're much more drawn to the things that really interest you than the kind of things you used to do, basically, because you were trying to build your career.
John Cleese, recorded in 1990. We're celebrating the 25th anniversary of Monty Python's Flying Circus. Michael Palin has said the group is unlikely to reunite because Python wouldn't be Python without Graham Chapman. Chapman died in 1989. In addition to being an inspired comic writer and actor, Chapman was a trained physician and a gay rights activist. We're going to hear an excerpt of the interview I recorded with him in 1987. First, a classic Python sketch.
I'd like to have an argument, please.
Certainly, sir. Have you been here before?
No, I haven't. This is my first time.
I see. Well, do you want to have just one argument, or were you thinking of taking a course?
Well, what is the cost?
Well, it's £1 for a 5-minute argument, but only £8 for a course of 10.
Well, I think it would be best if I perhaps started off with just the one and then see how it goes.
Fine. Well, I'll see who's free at the moment. Mr. DeBakey's free, but he's a little bit conciliatory. Ah, yes. Try Mr. Barnard, room 12.
Thank you.
What do you want?
Well, I was told outside that...
Don't give me that, you snotty-faced heap of parrot droppings!
What?
Shut your festering gob, you tit! Your type really makes me puke, you vacuous, toffee-nosed, malodorous pervert!
Look, I came here for an argument. I'm not going to just...
Oh! Oh, I'm sorry, but this is abuse.
Oh, I see. Well, that explains...
Ah, yes. You want room 12A, just along the corridor.
Oh, thank you very much. Sorry.
Not at all.
Thank you.
Stupid git.
That was Graham Chapman dishing out the abuse. I asked Chapman if his early sketches with Monty Python were considered too risque or eccentric.
Well, the BBC, to begin with, didn't like us very much, which was actually strangely in our favour, because they put us out at a very unpopular hour of the evening, late on a Sunday night, which is not a top slot in Britain. Also, they frequently preempted us with important things like horse show jumping. They generally didn't rate us very highly, which was good because that meant they didn't even bother to read the scripts. So that meant we could do more or less as we wanted. It wasn't until towards the end of the second series of programmes that they began to realise that we were picking up quite an audience. And then, of course, they began to read the scripts, and that did lead to one or two problems. Naughty words, really. Just silly, childish, naughty words that they would find objectionable, I suppose, because they probably had a problem with their early toilet training, the BBC.
That must be it.
Yes, I think so. Found sensitive areas. But we had then a sort of precedent to point to. We could say, but we said that in programme 3 or whatever, and they would listen to it and found out that we had, and they had no complaints. And so, you know, we could say, we can say it again then.
I think that there's a lot of British humour and Monty Python-type humour that a lot of Americans don't necessarily get because the language is so different?
Yes, I suppose there are. Although we were quite fortunate in that respect in that during the whole TV series, we tended not on the whole to use topical humour. So that has meant that it is relatively timeless, at least, although there obviously are one or two specific things that will be pretty meaningless now.
Well, what's your collaborating method when you are working together?
John and I wrote together, Michael Palin and Terry Jones wrote together, Eric wrote on his own, and then Terry Gilliam did all the animations, and the visual side of things.
So would you lock yourself up in a room and try to write sketches together?
Yeah, well, John and I would just meet up and sit there for an hour or so, trying to avoid work at all costs, drinking cups of coffee and reading the newspapers, talking about what was in the news, maybe anything to put off that awful moment of having to put something on paper. And then about an hour before lunchtime, we'd begin to feel guilty that we hadn't done anything, and at that point we would hopefully think of something which had either occurred during that first hour or so, or if not, then in desperation open up Roger's Thesaurus and simply look at a collection of words to see if that inspired anything, which it sometimes did.
I'll bet it did, because so many of your sketches were wordplay, and it wasn't logical, but it was hysterical.
Look at the cheese shop sketch, for instance.
Oh, and the cheese
almost
dancing.
almost directly from Roger's Thesaurus.
What did you look up that led to that?
Well, we were into cheeses anyway, so we simply looked at that point. We liked the idea of a shop which contained absolutely nothing that it claimed it sold, which is just a minor exaggeration of the way some British shops are. So that was what we were getting at, I think, and decided on cheese as being the comestible in point, and so just looked up a whole list of cheeses in Roger, added a few, and there it was.
Gouda?
No.
Edam?
No.
Caithness?
No.
Smoked Austrian?
No.
Japanese Sage Derby?
No, sir.
You do have some cheese, do you?
Of course, sir. It's a cheese shop, sir. We got...
No, don't tell me. I'm keen to guess.
Fair enough.
Wensleydale?
Yes.
Ah, well, I'll have some of that.
Oh, I thought you were talking to me, sir. Mr. Wensleydale, that's my name.
Greek feta?
Not as such.
Gorgonzola?
No.
Parmesan?
No.
Mozzarella? Pepper crema? No. Danish...
When you're a comic writer and you're writing with a collaborator, do you laugh at each other's funny lines?
Yes, and also laugh together, too. I mean, there's one whole sketch when John and I, we perhaps had gone a bit too far, but we felt guilty about it while we were writing it, which made us laugh hysterically. And that was the Undertaker's sketch. I mean, perhaps we had gone too far. You know, people taking their dead mothers into Undertakers in a sack, you know, it's on sort of tricky ground, isn't it?
And then they had to decide if they were going to burn them,
bury them,
or dump them.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes. That made us feel guilty, I suppose, because all the time we were thinking of our own dear mothers, and it is a bit far to go, isn't it?
Well, this is a real serious issue, I think. If you're writing humor like that, do you want your mother to hear it?
No, you don't. Fortunately, with John and I, we did frequently, I suppose, really think of our own mothers when we were writing sketches. John always used the excuse that it was my mother, and I always used the excuse that it was his. And they seemed to believe that quite satisfactorily.
Graham Chapman recorded in 1987. He died 2 years later. This Sunday marks the 25th anniversary of the first broadcast of Monty Python's Flying Circus in England. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Hi, Robert.
Hi, Terry. Today we have news of the settlement of the GM strike, also the latest from Haiti, story about the Senate race in Massachusetts, where Senator Kennedy is getting a run for a re-election. And also we have the winners of our Will and Rachel Sidewalk Romance Contest. Many, many listeners submitted entries in this short story competition. And on today's program, we will unveil the winners.
Well, thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Director Curtis Hanson began his career as the editor of Cinema Magazine before becoming the screenwriter of such films as Never Cry Wolf and The Silent Partner. His first film as a director was a thriller, The Bedroom Window, in 1987, and he's been making thrillers ever since, including the 1992 hit The Hand That Rocks the Cradle. His latest is a whitewater thriller about rivers, not Arkansas politics, and it stars no less than Meryl Streep. Film critic Stephen Schiff reviews The River Wild.
She doesn't do an accent. She doesn't get all haunted and mysterious. And believe it or not, she has biceps. The new Meryl Streep is, of all things, an action hero. And a surprisingly effective one. Her new movie, The River Wild, turns out to be a wilderness thriller of the most straightforward and conservative kind. Nothing in it will surprise or charm you unduly. But still, the picture moves and Streep moves with it. She plays a school teacher named Gail. Her marriage to an overworked architect played by David Strathairn is feeling the strain of his long hours and sour disposition. And now it's time for Streep, Strathairn, their young son, and their faithful dog to leave baby sister behind in Boston and go on a river rafting vacation in deepest Montana. Had anyone else been playing the lead, the setup would have seemed utterly perfunctory, but Streep invests everything she does with such deep-dish emotion, and Strathairn turns himself into such a sniveling, narrow-shouldered coward that their marital troubles almost distract you from the developing suspense plot. How could she have fallen for him, you keep wondering, and what have they been talking about over dinner all these years? Enter Kevin Bacon as Wade, an inexperienced rafter who's nevertheless going down the river with his sidekick. As Bacon's and Streep's rafts keep passing each other, Bacon seems just a little too charming. You can tell he's up to no good by the way he keeps ogling her and acting all fatherly to her son. In a thriller, substitute parenting always signifies evil. By the time the movie's half over, Bacon and his pal, both of whom, sure enough, are pretty evil, have hijacked Streep's raft, gotten rid of her husband, and are bent on forcing her to steer them through the gauntlet, which is more or less whitewater hell. As they approach the big cataract, Streep whispers a word of warning in Bacon's ear.
You listen to me, you little idiot. I'm not bullshitting you about the gauntlet. It's big. It's bigger than anything you've ever seen. And tomorrow, Wade, you're going to drown in it, and the rest of us are going to be hauled under with the raft. So I'm not going to pretend that I give a shit about you and your stupid friend and your pathetic, small-time, nothing life. But I got everything I care about in the world in this boat. And I got my baby girl waiting at the other end. And I know I cannot do this. I cannot row this big water, man. That's the truth.
In a scene like that, you can hear how much acting Streep throws into every line. And yet she never throws the movie out of balance. That's because she doesn't make the mistake of turning Gail into anyone very complex or soulful. Gail's a grown-up, but the giggly, outdoorsy kid that she was when she learned to ride the river is still there in every line. Director Curtis Hanson isn't too good at making the family stuff fresh, but he handles the whitewater scenes spectacularly. He makes the physical pleasure of dodging the rocks come through along with the terror. So, is Meryl Streep the next Arnold Schwarzenegger? Maybe not. But in this movie, she has the muscle, and we know she can do the accent.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Our program was co-produced today by our director, Roberta Shurrock, and Sue Spolin. For the past few months, Sue has helped hold things together here as our acting associate producer, backup director, and in-house massage therapist. She's leaving us for now to work on other projects. Sue, we thank you for your steady hand, sharp mind, and good humor. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Congress is appointing an independent commission to rethink the role of the CIA. Meanwhile, the agency is still reeling from the arrest of Soviet mole Aldrich Ames. Tim Weiner covers the CIA for the New York Times. On the next Fresh Air, we'll examine the condition of the agency. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.